to this, it's the island of Malta, it says in our biblical text, island of Malta today. And as you begin chapter 28, verse 1, that's where 28 begins, with them on that island. Now, as we look through chapter 28, we're going to look at a section, first of all, where they're shipwrecked on the island and the events that take place on the island. You know, the gospel needs to go everywhere. It needs to go in areas where there are concentrations of people into the cities. It needs to go onto the islands also. And so, in a turn of events here, this ship being wrecked here, the gospel is going to go to the island of Malta in a strange sort of way. It's going to go there by these individuals that have been shipwrecked there. But we'll look at that, and that will take account through verse 11. And then as we pick up with verse 12, we're going to be looking at Paul and his companions making this final push, the final journey to Rome. And we'll look at some of the places along the way and some of the brethren coming to meet him at various places when they hear he's on his way to Rome. And then we'll look at his arrival in Rome in 16 through 23 and the events that take place there, how Paul is taken aside and not treated as a prisoner as such, but put into his own house. And then we'll look in verses 27 through 31, the rest of the chapter, and we'll get just a small picture of Paul's actions while he's in Rome, his teaching and the things he's able to do there. It's a very quick chapter. It's a chapter that contains a lot of little historical things, but you've got to kind of read between the lines to get some great doctrinal teachings that are here. Because Paul, again, lives a life that is an exemplary life, and the people around him see this Christian life being lived. And so there's things are going to come up that gives Paul opportunity to teach these people as these events unfold. If you look at 28:1, when they were escaped, they knew that the island was called Melita. And the barbarous people showed us no little kindness, for they kindled a fire and received us every one because of the present rain and because of the cold. So they go here, they're on this island, and he calls us people a barbarous people. What's a barbarous people? Unchristian. We might look at it that way. Huh? Uncivilized. Actually, Paul's not using that term in that harsh a manner here. What you've got to realize is you got to get your mind of the Greek and Roman perception of it. Now, let's look at a couple of other verses that will help us with this. Go over to Romans chapter 1, verse 14. And we're going to know, now Paul uses this term about three times in the biblical text. I am a debtor to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and the unwise. Now what does barbarous mean? Anyone that's not Greek. And it becomes clearer to us in this text. So Paul says, I'm going to carry the gospel. I'm a debtor to take the gospel to the Greeks, but also to everyone else. And everyone else is classified as a barbarian. Now, this has to do a lot of times more with the language that a people speak than their nationality. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, you see it again, verse 11. We're just about to get to this on our Sunday evening study. Therefore, if I know not the meaning of the voice, I shall be unto him that speaketh a barbarian. And he that speaketh shall be a barbarian to me. Here he's talking about speaking in different languages. Paul said, if I speak a language that he can't understand, he would be a barbarian. And that's the sense the word's used here. The Greeks considered everyone that did not speak Greek to be barbarous or barbarians because they spoke some other language. So what Paul's telling us here, when they got to this island and they found themselves on it, these were not Greek-speaking people. Now, they were on a ship, probably, that had some people on it that weren't Greek-speaking people. Where was the ship from? Egypt, Alexandria, Egypt. And so probably there was some on the ship. But nevertheless, as they find themselves on this island, the island is not made up of people that speak the Greek language, so they're perceived to be a barbarous people. That's the term, that's the usage of the term. I don't think it's a term, it's an unkind term. He's not talking about these people as being a mean people. How do we know that? He showed us, and King James says, they showed us no little kindness. They showed us great kindness. So he's not talking about them being barbarous because of the way they were treated by the people. And so that distinction, is made here. Let's go back to Acts 28. Now, so this people here, notice the kind things they did. They kindled a fire. They received every one of the ones that were on the ship. Now, this is very significant. Tell me who was on the ship again. Roman soldiers. Egyptians. We already said it was a ship from Egypt, so it had Egyptian people to take care of the traveling of the ship, the handling of the ship. Who else? Prisoners, because Rome was transferring prisoners, of which one Paul was. And so you've got quite a makeup of people on this ship. I think Paul here gives a real good picture of this people on this island. It would have almost been easy for the people on the island to exclude certain people off of that ship. Wouldn't it have been easy to say, well, they're prisoners, let's set them aside? That didn't happen, see. And we know it didn't happen because of Paul's wording here. They showed kindness to all of them, everyone that was on the island. Now, how many were on the ship? 276. So when it says they showed kindness to us all, this had to be a great outflowing of benevolent love, of benevolent kindness at least, let's call it that. It's no small group. Now, and it talks about them building a fire, they kindled a fire. Put 276 people around the fire. You people that like to go camping. Put 276 people around the fire. Tell me something. Tell me something that's not actually stated in the text here. They either built a lot of fires or they built a huge fire. Because it would take a lot of fire to warm 276 people. Whatever they did, they took care of all of them. That's the force of the text. And I want us to see that it was quite an effort that went out to take care of them. Now, it said they did this because of the cold. What was the situation on ship just before these prisoners and these people made it from the ship to shore? All right, they're about to starve. They were hungry. They did eat and throw the food overboard. Then what? What was going on weather-wise? And that storm didn't quit because they hit land. That storm didn't quit because they were able to float to the shore. The storm is continuing. It's raining. I think he actually makes a reference to that because of the present rain. It's still raining. It's still storming. The wind's still blowing. They're just on land. And so these people put out a great deal of effort to take care of these 276 people that board the ship. You know, it's easy to read through two and move on. But two tells us a lot about the people on this island, doesn't it? Now, you find a people that's kind and a people that's good. A good, kind people would be more open to the gospel than a harsh, mean, vindictive people would be. But this is what Paul finds, and this is what these prisoners find on the island. All right, verse 3. And when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, there came a viper out of the heat and fastened on his hand. Now, you have a strange event here. Paul, what's he doing? He's picking up brush. He's bringing stuff. I thought they were fixing the fire, the people of the island. Paul was helping. You know, it's good to help people in need. But it's also good and well for people who are in need to help themselves. Find both examples here. That's what we imagine. I don't know that we're told any more than that. It's a small island. You go back to the map, it's not just a few miles across. It's not a large island, no. But at the same time, there evidently were several that lived on the island. Now, again, that shows the majority of the island. I don't think we've got a map that shows all of it. I cut it out because I was trying to go to Rome. But again, as we look at this, you see this the kindness that they happen. And while Paul's helping here, it says this viper came out and lashed on his hand. What's a viper? Not just a snake. It's a poisonous snake. Okay. And the evidence here from all that the expectation was, this was a very poisonous snake. Matter of fact is, the people on the island expected him to fall dead instantly. And when the barbarians saw the venomous beast hang on his hand, they said among themselves, no doubt this man is a murderer, whom they thought he had escaped the sea, yet vengeance suffereth him not to live. So they expected him to die from this snake bite. You know, snakes are strange creatures. We're afraid of all of them. Some of them are not, and of themselves are not dangerous. Matter of fact is, some snakes are very beneficial. You know, I know some people think that they've never seen a beneficial snake, but actually some of them do eat rodents and other snakes even. So, but this one evidently was a very poisonous snake. Matter of fact is, it says it two times in different ways. I know an individual one time was bitten by a copperhead, helping his son clean up some scraps around a new built house, and after dark, and reached down, picked up the pile, and bit him in the arm. And they rushed him to the hospital. The next morning, he signed himself out, released the hospital of all liability because he had a story, and he said, I've got to go to work. You know, so we're pretty mindset people sometimes. And he went to work that day, and then someone else came in and said, I'm going to go tell everybody. I know a person that's been bit by poisonous snakes. He's taken them and handled them, and now he's survived. So that's just what the Bible, that's not what the Bible talks about. If you go over to Mark 16, but that's what they were wanting to present, because his arm swole up great, great large, you know, very large from the snake bite. But in this case, Paul is bitten, though, and after he's bitten, go through the minds of these people on this island. What are they thinking about Paul? Okay, why would they suggest that he was a criminal? A murderer, matter of fact. And they take that the snake bite was punishment for the evil that he had done, that he had done the evil, and he survived the storm. And so now, so fate, you ever heard of fate? So fate would catch up with him. The particular event was that this viper came out and bit him, and now fate's going to catch up with him for his murder, and he would die. You ever heard anything like that? Nah. You know, I see some of you smiling and thinking about this, but you know, sometimes our reasoning is not too far from what the reasoning was here. I'm not saying it's correct reasoning, but sometimes we think in some of the same ways. Now, so they perceive Paul at this point to be a murderer. Why? Because he's bitten by a viper. He's been bitten by a snake. I want you to think with me. In the Bible is another individual. What? Thank you, Gary. Gary's before the horse. Job. Job was accused with this very same accusation. What kind of man was Job? Righteous. Job 1. Describes his righteousness, doesn't it? Now, as Job had three friends that come to him, and these three friends come, and as they comment to Job about the things that's going on in his life, what did they say to Job? Huh? All right, let's look. Job 8, verse 6. Bildad. He's the first one we'll look at. We'll look at all three of his friends very quickly here. If thou wert pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee and make the habitation of the righteous prosperous. Bildad says, well, you're not pure and upright. If you were pure and upright, Job, God would wake. He'd take care of you. God's not even listening to you, Job. All right, let's look at another. Job 4, verses 7 through 9, and Eliphaz, another of his friends. Job 4, 7. Okay, remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent, Eliphaz asked him, or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity, sow wickedness, reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and by the breath of his nostrils they are consumed. The roaring lion and the voice of the fierce lion and the teeth of the young lions are broken. He turns to Job and look at his reasoning with Job. Job, you are where you are because you're not innocent. You're where you are because you're not righteous. Job, you're where you are because you've evidently sown wickedness and now you're reaping the wickedness. There's nothing more dangerous than a little bit of truth misapplied. And that's what these friends of Job's are doing. They're taking something that's somewhat true. Is it not true? If you sow wickedness, you'll reap wickedness. If you sow righteousness, you'll reap righteousness. That's basically true. But friends, that does not mean that an individual that sows righteousness is never going to have any trials or tribulation of life. And Job is a prime example of that. Let's look at the last one, Job 11:20. This is Zophar. Okay. The eyes of the wicked shall fail, and they shall not escape, and their hope shall be as the giving up of the ghost. And he turns to Job and says, Job, you're like the wicked. Your eyes are going to fail. You're not going to escape. God is doing this to you. You're going to be totally lost in all this. Again, not understanding what was taking place. Listen to me carefully and listen to me with a generous heart toward what I've got to say at least. Brethren, sometimes we look at people that have disease, accident, great tribulations in life, and we ask the question, what has he done that God has punished this person this way? Yes, and our reasoning is not proper. Our reasoning is wrong. Go back to Job again now. Had Job done any wickedness or any evil? No. And so, who was wrong as we read the book of Job? Who's wrong here? Is Job wrong or are his friends wrong? Oh, let me, by the way, give you a warning. When you quote the book of Job, be sure you look who's talking before you quote it. Because in the book of Job, in quoting it, you can quote false doctrine that's set out by one of his friends because it is false. That's the story telling us that, Bob. Man, that's true. Job, God did allow these things to happen. You can read that in chapter 2 and in beginning of chapter 3, that God allowed this to happen to test, to try. He allowed Satan to come in and test and try Job. But still, Job was righteous. Just because things happen to us in life, that does not designate that we have done some great evil. We lived in Wisconsin in the particular city we lived in. We lived in the same block with the preacher for the, Assembly of Gods. And on one particular day, I don't know, our children all had the flu. And his wife saw fit to come down to the house and inform my wife that our children had the flu because of the evil and the wickedness that we were doing. And that if we weren't doing wicked and evil, our children wouldn't have the flu. less than a week, her children were in the hospital or something. So I don't know how that figures, you know. I do know that I smiled. I didn't go say what I wanted to say to her. But, you know, the sometimes we really carry this thing where we ought not to carry it. Now, Job, the book of Job, is a picture of what life is really about. And in Job 1, verses 11 and 12, and Job 2, verses 2 through 6, Job is pictured there as a righteous man, and it tells us that righteous people are tried. They have trials. They have tribulations. They have suffering in life. That doesn't make them unrighteous. What makes them righteous or unrighteous is what? Sin. What makes them righteous or unrighteous is how they respond to the trials and tribulations that they have in their lives. Oh, isn't that true? Think with me for a moment. The one person that has the accident or the terrible illness, he turns and says, "It's God's fault." The other person has the same type of accident or the same illness, he turns to God and prays to God for His help and benefits. The same trial, the same tribulation brought out unrighteousness, brought out righteousness. I knew a man, an individual one time that was 40 years old, had terminal cancer, a preacher. Went to visit John in the hospital. And he told me, he said, "Since I have been sick," he said, "I have done one of the most beautiful studies of 1 Corinthians that I've ever done in my life." He said, "I know I have very few days left." He said, "It is my goal to study the book of 1 Corinthians to all the depth I can study it to before I die." What a wonderful attitude in dealing with such a devastating disease. And yet somebody would sit back and say, "Well, he had that disease because he did some evil." We need to be careful because we make statements sometimes that are completely empty of truth. Now, as we look at this, Paul here, he has this viper. It bites him, verse 5, and he shook the beast off into the fire and felt no harm. Howbeit, when they looked, when he should have swollen or fallen down dead suddenly, but after they had looked a great while and saw no harm to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god. Now, can you see how fickle these people are? At one point, they look at this viper, lays on Paul's hand. They say, "Well, he's a murderer." A few minutes later, when Paul hasn't fallen down dead, now he is a... Yeah, how big is your picture of God? Their picture of God was no bigger than a human. No greater than a human that would not be put to death by the bite of a viper. So he's got to be a God. What's my picture of God? Does my picture of God ever fall short of what it should be? Is God simply someone I come and I sing to on Sunday morning? Or is God more than that? Is God simply a figment of man's imagination, just something that we've been taught to think about to help us overcome certain trials and temptations in life? Or is my God bigger than that? My friends, we live in a world that has minimized God. You want a picture of God? He spoke. And everything you and I see, touch, or know came into existence. You don't believe that? Go back and read Genesis chapter 1 sometime. step by step by step, he speaks everything into existence. And not only that, everything that you and I know is upheld by what? Oh, we'll test our scripture understanding here. Upheld by what? Go ahead, Carl. The word of his power. Why do the stars and the constellations, why all the planetary motions, why is it consistent? Why does the earth even exist? Why is there still man? Because God empowers it by his word. Have you realized all it takes? Go to 2 Peter chapter 3 and come down to verse 10. All it takes for all of it to end is what? That's right. He can speak us out of existence materially and speak us into a spiritual eternity in an instant. Friends, I am afraid we have forgotten the real picture of God. Now, these people on this island, they didn't have a picture of the true God. Their picture of a God was limited to human size. Well, it's interesting, you know, you go to India, and I have to relate it to that. That's the only thing I have to relate it to. I'm sorry if it comes back up, but we went over to India, went down to that one of those temples, and they had a temple to seven gods, I think it was, and it showed their heads on their idols of these gods on top of this temple. And you sit there and you look at all those gods that they picture and you say, how sad it is in their limited view. You know, their limited view of God has developed over 2,500 different gods that they worship. And it's like the Greek gods. You know, they couldn't, in developing in their mindset a picture of God, they couldn't picture a God that was over everything, so they pictured gods over different things, a God of thunder, Thor, and so forth. And while that is sad, it's sad when we also have a limited view of God because we fail to come face to face and recognition of. We need to contemplate God from his word more. We need to study to see who he is, what he wants, what he's done, what he gives, and how he saves. Then we begin to get a picture of God. If I'm not willing to look at those things, I cannot picture God at all. And so these people here, the statement they've made is a statement void of truth. Paul was not a God. Was Paul ever accused of being a God before? Where was that? Athens, he talked about the unknown God. Huh? Yeah, that was Paul and Silas, wasn't it, that was there? Call one of them Mercury and the other Jupiter. Where was that? Laodicea? Laconia? Okay. You can look that up some other time. But you know, so this is not the first time that Paul's come into Lystra's word at. I found it in a note here, all right? So Paul and his companions then, they're on this island. They have a place to stay. Verse 7. In the same quarters were possessions of the chief man of the island, whose name was Populus, who received us and lodged us there 3 days courteously. And it came to pass that the father of Populus laid sick of a fever and of a bloody flux, to whom Paul entered in, prayed, and laid his hands on him and healed him. So when this was done, others also which had the disease came and were healed. And so Paul is taken in by this man, and by the way, his name Populus means popular. That's where the word comes from. It might show that he was a leader or popular with the people, or it might just be a name that he's been given. But anyway, Paul goes in where his father is sick, and what does he do here? He heals him. Now, healing was given to the apostles for what purpose? prove that you were from God. Mark 16, verse 20. That's the very purpose of this, is to be able to demonstrate to others that this individual was the messenger of God and the things that they were saying were the things of God. Now, when the apostles healed, what did they also do? They preached. Now, it is proper to come to the inference here that Paul, in that he healed the sick, he also preached the gospel. Now, it's not specifically stated, but that's what the apostles always did when they were healing. That was the purpose of healing. Matter of fact, healing without the preaching of the gospel would be empty, would be vain. It would be using the healing for a purpose other than it was intended. The giving of the healing was so that the gospel message could be taught and would be accepted as being from God. And so here they do that. There are some that are healed here in our text, and they stay there in that particular place for 3 days. Now, as they are on the island here, they get verse 10, honored us with many honors. And when we would depart, they laded us with such things as were necessary. So many things go on this island. In a short few verses here, we have recorded, verse 11, what took place over a 3 months period. Boy, it's amazing to me sometimes how in the Bible the chronology gets lost. This is one of those places. They weren't there just a short few days. They weren't there, I think it said about 3 days back in the other verse, they stayed with this man. They went other places. They were on the island for a 3 month period. Okay, and then after 3 months, they departed a ship of Alexander, which wintered in the isle, whose sign was Castor and Pollux. So after a 3 month period, there was another ship that had stayed there for the winter. They got passage on it. I don't know how many of them got passage on it. I know Paul and his companions and the Romans did. Now, this ship was also from Alexandria. What's this Castor and Pollux? They're twins. Huh? No. They're pagan gods. They're pictured as twins. Some say they're sons of Zeus or sons of Jupiter. And so you have here again a presentation of how strong this paganism was. And so, they're traveling on this ship. You could get in a whole debate. Would it be right to travel on a ship? Never mind. Paul is a what? Prisoner. Friends, sometimes living in the world, you're associated with things that are worldly. And that's what you have here. They travel on this pagan ship. The ship that they were traveling on when they got here was a pagan ship. And so they do travel on this. They land at Syracuse. And if we'll bring the map back, we'll find they've just gone a short way here. They've gone from Malta up to Syracuse. They stay there, what did it say, 3 days? And then let's go on back to our text. As we move on from there, they go on and they go to, it says, passing a compass, they came to Rhegium. After 1 day, the south wind blew. We came the next day to Puteoli. We'll go back to our map, go up a page. So they come around this. They come by Rhegium. The next day, they go up here to Puteoli, up on Italy itself. So they're well on the way to Rome at this point. And then they leave Puteoli. They go on up, at Puteoli, let's get 14, where we found brethren and were desired to tarry with them 7 days, so we went toward Rome. And so at Puteoli, they encouraged them to stay with them. They wanted them to stay 7 days, back up to 14 there, Derek, in our text. Okay, you need to make a correction in your outline at this point. And there where it talks about them staying at Puteoli, let me get down to the very... it's Roman numeral 2b. I don't believe he stayed there for 7 days. We found brethren and were desired to tarry with them 7 days. If you read that text very carefully, it indicates that the brethren there wanted them to stay 7 days. It's not a statement that they desired and that they stayed 7 days, but the brethren wanted them to stay 7 days. I think when I did the outline, I had one understanding of it and went back and did some checking on it. So you might want to mark that. The word that we're dealing with there, the desired, is actually a word which means invited. They were invited to tarry 7 days. That was an invitation from the brethren. It was not the mindset of Paul. Actually, Paul had very little to say. Why? He's a prisoner. So probably the indication is better that they invited them here. All right, the brethren then spread the word of Paul's coming, and brethren from Rome came as far as Appii Forum and three taverns to meet Paul. See that in verse 15. We'll go back to our map and look at the, well, we see the places talk about, go down to the next page. I think it'll show it better. Yeah, right here is three taverns, Appii Forum. So that the people from Rome come down there to meet Paul, so that because they hear that he's coming. And again, this shows their great love for Paul. What caused the brethren at Rome to love Paul? How? He'd written to them. The book of Romans was written before this point. But he had actually not been present with them. He taught them by letter. He sent them the letter, and I don't know if there was more than that, but we do know that that was his attachment. All right, and then Paul arrives at Rome, and this begins a very active period. Verse 16, and Paul came to Rome, and the centurion delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard, but Paul was suffered to dwell by himself with a soldier that kept him. All the other prisoners went where? Now went to prison, and Paul is able to stay, dwell by himself with a soldier, probably chained to that soldier. That's the usual way of doing this, at least. It's interesting. He delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard. And out of all of the military terms we have in the New Testament, for the captain of the guard, we have a military term that's only used this one time. Now, we have seen the term captain, the chiliarch of a cohort, the one who's over 1,000 men. We've seen that term used several times. This word's just a little different than that word. This word means the captain of the camp. Only time it's used. For a period of time in Rome, the individuals who were over the Roman army felt like that there was too much fraternization between the Roman army and the people in Rome, and especially the people of Caesar's household. So they moved that army outside of Rome to a camp and made them go outside the city and camp, and then they would go from the camp back into the city each day to take care of the responsibilities, and they would come back to camp at night. And the term that Luke has used here is specific, that this captain was the captain of a camp. And when you look back in secular history, it matches exactly what was taking place in the day and the time period that Paul was at Rome. And so, again, you get this secular support of the Bible being true on this account. You know, sometimes in ages gone by, translators have tried to change different ways that these words were translated because they didn't understand what was going on. Well, this is one such place. The army was in a camp, and Luke uses exactly the right term to describe it. Okay, so as they arrive, this is the things that take place here. Paul is in his own house, 16. He's able to be in his own house. He's able to do the things, preach from that household. He's able to invite others into that household. That's going to bring us down. We're going to mark verse 17. Now then, I've got just a few minutes. We're almost done. I need to do one other thing, and it's going to take a few minutes. I need a couple of... Josh, go in there in my office and bring one of those boxes sitting on the end of that table, and he needs somebody to help him because there's two of them.